Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison for STEM Spots, and you are listening to the web version of STEM Spots. And with me today is Dr. Vashti Sautel, an associate professor with Michigan State University in the Department of Physics. Thanks for stopping by, Vashti.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you and I have talked a little bit, and I've listened to some of the things you've been talking about, which regards to underrepresentation in the STEM fields, specifically primarily physics, engineering, and computer science, although to a certain extent others. And it's kind of notable because in physics and in the university in general, we're about numbers in a lot of ways. You're told student credit hour production, number of majors, percentage of this, retention rates, recruitment rates, and so forth. But the fact that at some level we have issues like this, certainly in physics and astronomy, is more than just a numbers game. So talk about what it's about that's more than numbers.
Yeah. So I always think about this as I'm a physicist. And so when I see a number that looks wrong to me, I don't think, oh, I found the problem, but rather I ask, what's the mechanism that underlies the problem? And so when I see 21% of bachelor's degrees awarded in the United States to physics students are to women, I wonder, where are the other students? And we know they're in college, we know they're getting bachelor's degrees, they're just not going to physics. And when I ask, where are they? I find them in the physics classrooms. Most of the degrees in the United States and the STEM fields require 1 to 2 semesters of physics. But those students come into our classes, they encounter our content, but they don't major in our classes. And so when I think beyond the numbers, I start to say, okay, there's something I don't actually believe it's the content of physics, right? I think physics is beautiful. So there must be something more about what students understand physics to be or what it means to be a physics person that keeps them from choosing that path. And that, I think, is a question of culture and perception.
Now, let's talk about that a little bit more, because I was a department head for many years, and I've done a tremendous amount of recruitment, and I'm sure you have too. And we're confronted with this issue all the time where we see stereotypes that have cropped up and perceptions that have cropped up, and I'm talking to an 18-year-old or a 17-year-old or a 16-year-old, and the perceptions are, let's call them misguided perceptions or incorrect perceptions, are already firmly in place. So how much can we do at the university? How much do we need to try to work on doing for students when they're younger? I mean, have you thought about that kind of those parts of it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is a question that the field of education thinks about a lot, is where do you start? Where do you start a problem that is pervasive and that goes through the fields? And I think the thing that I hold to for myself is that you should try and fix the problem that's in front of you. And for me, I work at the university. So that is the problem that I am trying to fix. I recognize that the problem that you just described of the stereotypes and perceptions are starting somewhere in middle school. That's where what all the data says. But I am not a middle school teacher. I don't even have contact with middle school directly. So I need to solve the problem that's in front of me. And that's at the university level.
And what kinds of things would you do? So you're saying you've got to make the problem at some level, an individual one, and deal with what part of it that you can deal with. So that sounds perfectly logical. What kinds of things would we do?
So the first thing that I did, and I've spent a number of years actually working on this problem, is I asked, I said, you know, so many of these students are in our classes, they're just not choosing our field. And then a lot of universities, we actually differentiate these students. We have the physics for scientists and engineers class, and then we have the physics for the life science majors. They go by different names, but a lot of universities differentiate them this way. And when we teach those physics for life science majors, we, in many ways, have not even tried to think about how that course should be different than the physics for scientists and engineers class. And so from my stance, one of the things that we do is we write off the possibility of recruiting students by connecting to things that we know that they care about before that we even give them the chance to think about it. And the way that we do that usually is by focusing on what I call 18th century physics, instead of bringing our physics classes into the modern century with us and asking about the places that physics connects to things that they care about, like at the cellular level, to medicine, to world problems like climate change and that sort of thing.
Well, you know, that's very interesting to me because I agree completely. And I've talked to many, many people about this for many, many years. And it seems to me, and tell me if you think this might sound right, that most of the time university professors, or many of the times university professors, see themselves creating many versions of themselves. It's like a bad movie where they basically say, I went to grad school and became a physicist, and this is the path I took, which was Newtonian mechanics, electricity, you know, the whole thing. And so they see everything at the undergraduate level as merely mimicking this way that you become a practicing PhD physicist. So I feel that's very misguided. And it sounds like at some level, you would say that that's also part of the problem. Is that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what you just described it is exactly where I am, is that we often treat even the introductory classes as just mini versions of graduate school classes on the way to becoming a physicist without really thinking about who these students are and what we want them to get out of these classes. And I'll go a step further and say, when I think about maybe it's the mini version of me that I'm actually teaching to, because I've often said if anyone had introduced me to biophysics earlier in my career, I would probably be a practicing biophysicist now, because that physics is cool.
It is.
And it's very interesting. And no one ever introduced that to me as an introductory student. So maybe I'm still doing that. And it's just the past version of myself that I'm designing these classes to say, like, look at this cool physics. And you can totally do this cool physics as a physics person. You don't have to be a biology person to do this kind of cool stuff.
Well, you know, that's interesting to me because basically a book like Halliday and Resnick, which has been around since the beginning of time and is now continued under somebody else's name, I'm not even sure who it is, when they decided to go biocentric, which would have been something like 1988, the way they did that was instead of a projectile being thrown, they had a lion leap into a tree or something like that, a leopard, I guess, which I always thought was so contrived. It drove me crazy even then. Instead of actually trying to delve into the stuff that bio and life science students wanted to look at, it just took everything we were already doing and contrived to ostensibly make it bio in nature. Did you ever notice that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So in my postdoc research, I worked with a team called Nexus Physics. And one of the questions that we asked was, what does it mean to create an authentic physics problem that relates to biology? And so our version of this is, there's this standard cheetah and an antelope question.
Yes,
where the cheetah is chasing the antelope. And it's really just the same question as, you know, two speeding cars.
Yes,
just replaced with a different
object. I hate that so much.
Yeah. So we ask questions about what does it look like to truly make an authentic question or situation. And one of the things that is one of my go-tos for making sense of this, well, I have two things. One is, if you don't know biophysics, don't try and pretend that you do.
Yeah.
So go find someone to talk to. And then the second thing is, I think of it as bringing big ideas that are across the science disciplines into interaction with each other. So one of my go-to examples of this is entropy. So entropy is taught in all of the science classes, but for students, it often seems like it's a different concept for every class.
That's a fact.
The question is, how do you take something like Gibbs free energy, which is really an entropic equation that is used in biology all the time, and bring it into physics so that the microstates way of thinking about physics is actually present for students and thinking about Gibbs free energy as well. And that's one way to think about how to make those problems feel more authentic to students.
I agree. Let me ask you two things. So first of all, one thing I would ask is that, so a lot of times people will say, well, how will the students know what they need to know? And I've always asked people, well, let me get this straight. Since most of them will have forgotten every single thing they learned in this physics class in, let's be generous and say, 5 years, what is it that you think you're accomplishing? That's the first thing. And then the second thing is, some people will tell me, well, Dave, the textbooks are written this way for a reason. And I say, no, there was no pedagogical research in 1910 or 1890 when they decided to teach physics this way. It's just the way it got laid out, and it's been done that way ever since. Have you thought about those sorts of issues?
Yeah, absolutely. And I can't agree with you more about the idea of textbooks. I think the way I understand textbooks is we just keep adding to them.
Yeah.
We don't ever like bust them apart and think about how we could rebuild them from scratch. There are a couple of examples of that that have come up in recent past, but they're not well known. They're, you know, one-off kind of books that people do here and there. I have completely forgotten.
Well, what about this idea that you're supposed to be giving some knowledge to these people so that they can be mini physicists someday? Wouldn't you say that's erroneous?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So the most common critique that I hear when I talk about this redesign of class is how will students see the beauty of physics if they don't teach
that's
them
funny.
The
that's
models,
funny.
Right? And exactly, my response is exactly is they don't see the beauty of physics anyway. That's not what they're getting from your class. So why are you trying to shove it down their throats? That's not working. And instead, I want to argue that there is beauty in seeing how physics connects to other disciplines and other kinds of problems than what physicists have traditionally solved. And my very cynical answer is if we want physics to look different in 100 years, then we have to start changing it now and stop teaching the same stuff that we've been teaching for 100 years, or we're going to get left in the dark.
Well, let me ask you a connected question to that, because I agree with you completely about everything you said. And so now let's talk about the idea of what's important in a department. So I'll give you an analogy. At most PhD schools, everybody knows that the PhD in English is built off the backs of freshman comp, which is where every teaching assistant in English is, pretty much. And I was taught English in 1977 by a TA who was an English PhD student. And so nobody would claim, even though there are sometimes freshman composition centers and so forth, most people wouldn't claim that English professors are most concerned with the freshmen that they're trying to get to become proficient in English, but instead are most concerned with their own majors. And so I see that part of the problem is this. Part of the problem is that physics departments survive mostly on the student credit hour production and TAs associated with engineering physics and life science physics. Everybody knows that that's the fact. Or maybe intro astronomy also. There's a lot there too. But yet their hearts are in trying to help their own majors. And so they view it as a cost benefit sort of a thing. How much of that do you see?
Oh, absolutely. And I can't tell you how many faculty meetings I have been in where I get so upset because of people actually go to the number of dollars per student and start making arguments about how much students are worth in different paths. So definitely that's part of the problem is we just don't care enough. And so that's what part of the reason why I go to two different places depending on who I'm speaking with. If I'm talking to that physicist who just really loves what they do, that's where I'm going to, this physics is cool. I know that you had a terrible thermodynamics experience and you hated statistical mechanics because most of us did. But if you can get yourself to go back to that, now that you have this expert view on physics, you're going to find that it's really beautiful stuff. And it's really cool to be able to talk about motor proteins moving through our bodies and saying that's really just Newton's laws. It's cool to be able to see that kind of connection.
Absolutely.
And the other way that I go to it, if that's not the person I'm talking to, is back to this demographics question. And if we want to change who does physics, then we have to go to where those students are. And when you look at the life sciences, they are 55% female, right? Chemistry is more than 50% female. So if you want to see the number of women change who are getting bachelor's degrees in physics, then we need to connect to ideas about chemistry, to connect to ideas about life science, to pull some of those students who are really interested in the math and the mechanism, to pull them back into physics and say, you can do the stuff you care about in our spaces as well. You don't have to be in the life sciences to do that.
So let me ask you about something that's related to that. Now, I don't think you've had the privilege, I guess I would call it, of assigning people their teaching loads yet. Is that true?
That is true. I have not done that.
So you probably are a very perceptive person and you probably observe everything quite a bit. And many times when you give a person a class, perhaps that they haven't taught before or that they're worried about or something like that, the very first question out of their mouth is, what is the textbook? Have you noticed this? And so, I mean, I don't want to tell a dirty little secret, but at some level, faculty are not always necessarily 100% committed to the education of undergraduates, but many times I have found they view the university as more like a research center where they hang their hat, and the teaching is something they do because that's what they get paid for. Do you think that influences the outcome of this situation?
Yeah, I think it does. Although I would say that perception of what teaching is, I would see changing over the last decade or so. I think more and more people are interested in these innovative ways of teaching and interested in understanding how they could try them out. And my best example of that is a faculty member who I was supporting and learning ways of teaching. And they came into my office and they said, I love this because I actually get to hear what students think. And in all of my teaching before this, I've never actually got to hear how they're thinking about problems. And it's just fun. This teaching is more fun. And so the question about how do we make teaching more fun alongside doing something better for students, I think is an approach that we can use to get people more interested in what we're doing. The second version of it is absolutely, we have to lower the activation barrier.
Yes.
We have to make it so that the materials are accessible and available. And this is where I think the 21st century is our best friend. So the idea of you need a physical textbook is just wild to me, right? Like we have online textbooks at our fingertips. We can search for any kind of basic physics knowledge that we need. Khan Academy has videos on everything, right? So I think one of the things that I see as a path forward and what I do actually is I use our learning management system to actually put up readings about these topics that are in my course and are shareable then with another faculty member. You know, we can export that course and send it over. And the Nexus Physics course that I worked on, they made what they call a wiki book. That was one of the main projects. And so that's hosted on the CAPADRE, which is the American Association of Physics Teachers site. And you can go and assign those web page readings to any student at any time. And so if you're asking yourself, how could I build in a fluids unit into my introductory class, you could actually say, I'm going to use Halliday, Resnick, and Walker, and then I'm going to go assign this fluids reading that's on a website somewhere and have students read it there instead of relying on the textbook.
Well, you know, the point I made about the textbook, it doesn't have to be online or paper. The bigger point is that, as you know, creating curriculum and really thinking thoughtfully through a class, especially if it's one you've never taught before, and even more so if it's one that has never been taught at the university before, takes a tremendous amount of time. Mm-hmm. And you have to think about, how am I going to tie this together, and how am I going to put this together, and how am I going to do this? And if you have a textbook, you say it's section 3.1. Mm-hmm. And that's why people like textbooks so much. Mm-hmm. Is because if you're spending, and you know how some physicists are, I don't know about other academic disciplines, but I know people who still routinely spend 40 hours a week in their lab. Forget about their teaching responsibilities and everything else. Just in their lab, they're spending something like 40 hours a week. So they feel, how shall I put it, overwhelmed sometimes, especially if they're trying to make something, I don't know, new or novel. And that's why I want to ask about these efforts in the biological physics, because I know that a couple of places are actually trying this now. Now, I mentioned this to Pearson 8 years ago, and they asked me if I wanted to write a textbook, because I told them, I sketched this whole idea out. And then I said two things. First of all, this isn't my area of research, and so I'm not an expert on it. And then the second thing is, I've got other grants, and I'm working in my lab, and I just don't feel like I could possibly do it without basically devoting, I don't know, 5 years of your life to it. So are there efforts going on right now that you see that can attack, for example, that particular problem, the one about the life sciences and the way we teach physics in it?
Yeah, so the Nexus Physics project that I keep referencing, right, that was the whole purpose of that project, was to develop a whole course, both the mechanics portion, electricity and magnetism, optics, all of those pieces of a class, in a way that it would be semi-plug and play. But the lead on that project, Professor Joe Reddish, he also really believes in adaptable materials. And so everything there is open source. and editable. And if you haven't heard of the Living Physics Portal, that's a place I would point you to, where you can actually find curricular materials that are all meant to be open source and editable. You can also submit materials. So if you've written life science materials, you can submit materials there. They take everything. So from, you know, problems that you might give in homework, laboratories, but also readings and that sort of thing. And it's a combined set of universities across the country that are working together to create that platform. But also they're always looking for people to grow and contribute to that community. And there's a really great set of materials.
Those sound great. Are they edited or is it buyer beware?
That's a good question. So they have actually two versions of this, and this is becoming more and more common in the physics education community, is you can have a, I don't remember exactly what they call it, but it's like community contributed materials that are just, you know, you submitted and you said they were good. And then you can also contribute your materials to what they call the vetted library. And the vetted library has a team of editors who go through and evaluate your materials and then, you know, ask you for revisions and things more close to like a journal publication to say this is vetted by the community together to say that it's worthwhile.
Great. Now, to end up on, because this is great and it dovetails with things that we would like to see, and I think, to be totally honest, I agree with you completely, they need to happen. But inertia is an interesting beast, as you know. So how about some of these efforts that you talked to me about bridging, about efforts at the university level to try to bridge with other places, like, for example, community colleges?
Right. So this is an area, this is very related actually to the point I made earlier of if you want to change what physics looks like, we need to go to the places where these students are. And if you look at the numbers, you can see that community college is the place where students from historically marginalized groups often start their college trajectory. But many of them never actually finish the bachelor's degree, never transfer to the university. And so if we want to see students from first-generation families, from low-income families, from Black and Brown families, students who started a path, maybe our parents themselves and are trying to finish a degree, if we want to see those students be part of the physics community, then community college is the place where they are. And so the question that I have been researching with my team is how do we better support those students as they transition from the community college to the university? And that in some ways means supporting them at the community college, but in many ways it's helping them envision a path for themselves that ends up at a bachelor's degree as opposed to ends up in the community college classroom. And so what we've been doing there is we've partnered with a couple of community colleges in Michigan and built relationships with those institutions and those faculty and those students to try and understand how to better create those pathways as they come from the community college to the university setting.
That's great. Let me ask you one last thing and then we'll finish up. When you have something like that and you need on the front end committed humans, and at some level, you need institutional support. How can you, and this is the thing that I worry about with a lot of the things I've been involved in, because I've been involved in a number of initiatives that last and then, as you know, sustain. How can you sustain these things? What makes it become sort of, it's just, how does it become part and parcel of what we do rather than a one-off?
Yeah, so this is my big point in my world right now is that we have to focus on building relationships and not on just fixing problems. So if we actually have real relationships with the faculty who are at the community college, if we have real relationships with the life science students who are in our classrooms or with the biophysics faculty who are in a different department on our campuses, then those efforts don't just disappear because there are people attached to them. And we are all humans that want those relationships in our lives. And so we will sustain them because that's what we do as humans. The question of institutional support is a little more murky. How do you make that happen? But I would argue that if you have two faculty members at two different institutions who are really committed to making a path, the institutions will follow suit. This is maybe a grassroots effort kind of vision of how change happens. But I really believe that if we can focus on building those relationships and making those sustainable, then those efforts that we're changing will also become more sustainable.
Well, those are all great ideas, and I wish you the best luck in all your efforts. Dr. Sautel, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this is Dave Cornelison for STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.